There's nothing that lights me on fire more than talking about some of the most important ideas of our time in a historical context with experts. My name is Maggie Dawn. Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. And this woman is on fire. Her name is Heather Cox Richardson. She's a professor of history at Boston College, an expert in the Civil War Reconstruction. She's taught at MIT, UMass Amherst, and she has one of the most widely read Substacks called Letters from an American. I subscribe to it. It is amazing. It fills me every day with new information and insights, and she's here today to share all of that with each one of you. Welcome, Heather. Thanks so much for making time.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here.
We've got so much to talk about, so I'm do not pass go. Just jump right in. You wrote a book in 2023 called Democracy Awakening, Notes on the State of America. It is on the New York Times bestseller list. It does incredibly well. But let's start there. What is the state of America, most specifically the state of our democracy in America? And we'll dig into some of the details there throughout this interview.
We're in a really interesting moment right now, I think, in our history. So that book was originally written to explain the question that people ask me most, which is, how did we get here? What on earth is going on? And how we get out? So it's three different sections that cover those things. But since that book came out about a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, I think, we have seen, I think, the what I tried to identify in the book, which was a growing pro-democracy movement in the United States to push back against 40 years in which we had lost the guardrails of our democracy and began to create first a sort of oligarchy that became, under former President Donald Trump, the potential for a dictatorship. Now, in this particular moment, that movement for democracy, which is not about the Democrats, by the way, it's about those people who care about American democracy, is in an existential standoff against the people who are supporting the MAGA Republicans, who have very openly called for overturning democracy. And of course, in about, I think it's 45 days from when we're recording, be a little bit less about than that when this goes on the air, we will decide which of those two visions of America is going to dominate the other. And so as a historian, I look at this moment and I think, you know, this is really it. This is one of those extraordinarily crucial moments in the survival of American democracy. And the question is whether the people will prevail as they have in our past or the authoritarians.
One of your recent letters, if I will, believe this is from September 17th, you quoted at length Benjamin Franklin's thoughts and sentiments as he recorded them as the Constitution was debated at the Constitutional Convention. And you ended with some of Benjamin Franklin's words as they approached the final vote after this protracted, passionate debate about exactly the words of our nation's founding, one of our nation's founding documents. And you quoted Mr. Franklin saying this, quote, "I agree to this Constitution with all its faults, if they are such, because I think a general government necessary for us. And it astonishes me to find this system approaching so near to perfection as it does. And I think it will astonish our enemies who are waiting with confidence to hear that our states are on the point of separation, only to meet hereafter for the purpose of cutting one another's throats. On the whole," he said to his colleagues, "I cannot help expressing a wish that every member of the convention who still may have objections to it would with me on this occasion doubt a little of his own infallibility and to make manifest our unanimity, put his name to this instrument." And on September 17, 1787, they did so. What I think that brings to mind for me, Heather, is the call today to each and every one of us to effectively reaffirm the Constitution, though we may have quibble or draw some criticisms, that now is our time to each be a Ben Franklin. What do you think of this moment that faces American voters?
Well, I think that's right. And I love that quotation from Franklin, partly because he's an old man by then. I think he's 81, and he's seen so much of the world. And what he says is, you know, this isn't what I would have done all the way, but, you know, maybe I'm wrong. I mean, he literally says, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this is the right way to go in certain places. And that humility, I think, is crucial in this moment. But I also think that one of the things that I didn't identify in that piece, but I think is so important, is that what Franklin is saying, well, first of all, is that if we don't do this, in his case, it was very clear that other countries were sitting there waiting to tear the States apart. And of course, nowadays we have Russia and Iran and China and other countries that would do the same to today's United States. But that also he is looking at what it means to be a member of a democracy. And that is, they created a document and then they gave us the ways to change it. And what he's saying is, you know, in my lifetime, I've seen a whole lot of stuff. And this looks really good to me. But if it isn't good in certain places, we can change it. Well, and that's what it means to be a member of a democracy, is to recognize that there isn't some perfect moment or perfect past that we can get back to. That serves authoritarians by saying there are absolute rules in the world, and so long as you put a strong man in place, he will bring them back, erasing anybody who opposes him. But the democracy is really about saying, let's see how it works for us to do this. And if it doesn't work, let's adjust it. And then we'll adjust it again. And then we'll adjust it again. And democracy then is not about an end game. The process is the end game. And that, you know, it's, I love that thing from him, because so many, I just actually on the plane out here, I just reread Madison's minutes from the Constitutional Convention, you know, as one does, right?
Yeah, but, right. In our free time.
But they're so, I don't know, humorless partly, but also so all of those guys are absolutely convinced that they know exactly what to do next. And then Franklin, who's way older than all of them, sort of sits there and he's been through everything. He sort of sits there and says, boys, you know what? We're not all perfect. Let's see how we can live together. It's just a wonderful moment.
Yeah, that it's something that I touch upon frequently in dialogue with all of you out there, our listeners, in that one of the things that I look for in elected officials and political leaders is that idea of humility, this openness that I may be wrong. And so what does that require of me when assessing a specific policy or a moment, right? And one of the things that has concerned me so deeply since the rise of the MAGA movement is the absolute certitude of things, right? And that, I think, really poses its own sort of existential threat. I want to ask you about yet another very recent post, which I think builds upon this idea that we're talking about here, Heather. On the 19th of September, you talked about the fact that, frankly, our founding fathers didn't believe in political parties, didn't want them, but we've evolved into a party system. And you wrote this, which I think speaks so deeply to this tipping point that we find ourselves at. You wrote, quote, democracy depends on at least two healthy political parties that can compete for voters on a level playing field. Although the men who wrote the Constitution hated the idea of political parties, they quickly figured out that parties tie the voters to the mechanics of Congress and the presidency. And they do far more than that. Before political thinkers legitimized the idea of political opposition to the king, disagreeing with a person could lead to execution or banishment. And you go on to say that the parties are a way, they're part of the system that allows for the peaceful transition of power, but that is only legitimate. It only works when there is a level political playing field for everyone, quote, so that a party must constantly compete for voters by testing which policies are most popular and getting rid of the corrupt or unstable leaders voters would reject, end quote. Wow. Boy, that sure sounds like an indictment of the modern Republican Party, which I've said many times, I think has lost any claim to political legitimacy in today's America. Your thoughts?
Well, so you've identified that, I think, correctly. But one of the things I was trying to do in that post was point out that the modern day Republican Party is a mess. I mean, it's in the middle of a civil war itself. And the people that it has put up Most recently, the stuff that's come out about Mark Robinson of North Carolina, although we knew he was no prize, right? Yes. And they still signed on to him. But Matt Gaetz, and you know, I could just go down the list, James Comer, and of course, former President Donald Trump and J.D. Vance. I mean, they're not bringing their best, right? And no. So when you write about that, when somebody like me writes about that, people have said, oh, you're a shill for the Democrats, because the Democrats don't have that kind of scandal. And to the degree they do, like with Robert Menendez, who was convicted of working for a foreign government recently, they got rid of him. You know, yes. they purged them. So in fact, in this moment, it's very, very difficult. People are like, oh, she's not both sidesing this. Well, you really can't, because the reality is one party has gone over the cliff and the other party is still pretty normal.
Yes.
And I'm not the first to say that by any stretch of the imagination. This was identified, a number of people have been identifying it for a long time. Historically, people like me, but Thomas Mann and Norm Ornstein wrote a very famous book and a series of articles in 2012 that said, hey, listen, the problem's the Republicans. But what I was really trying to do there was to say, there's a systemic reason for that. And I kind of think about it like a soccer game of all things. And that's that if you're playing on an even playing field, two soccer teams have to compete against each other. They both have to get good. They have to get good players. They have to work out. They have to try harder and harder to beat the other team. But when one team starts to play the refs, they don't have to be quite as good, right? But the other team has to be better, because they've got to walk uphill, right, against those refs. And then if all of a sudden the weak team gets to have more players and the good team gets fewer players, I mean, you can see where this is going. One team has to get leaner and meaner and better and better. And the other team can, you know, have some guys who don't play very well, and then can have some people who really don't play very well but are well connected, and so on. And what you end up with in this situation is one in which the game is so skewed that either those players who at this point have the refs and they have the better field and they have the better equipment and they have the more people and they have the rules in their favor, they either are going to have to simply destroy the other team, or the other team is going to say, this isn't my game anymore and I don't want to play it. And if you extrapolate that back onto politics, that's exactly the way political theory talks about political parties. You need to have healthy political parties so that the players on both teams, if you will, truly believe that they can elect their people and that their people are good enough that they're going to be able to run the country. And what we have right now is a system in which the Republicans so rigged the system beginning in about 1986 by getting rid of voters under the lie, really, of voter fraud. And it's important to remember that voter fraud is an individual who votes and shouldn't. Election fraud is when you steal an election. And those are very different things. In fact, the Republicans often engage in election fraud. But voter fraud doesn't really happen in the United States. So between stacking the courts with their own people so they make decisions that do things like gut the Voting Rights Act, the Citizens United decision that puts money into, you know, on and on until we get the gerrymandering, the extraordinary gerrymandering after the redistricting project of 2010, what you've got is a party in which people do not have to compete for votes because they know they're going to win. And so you can put in the Lauren Boberts and the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Mark Robinsons and those people who are really not good representatives of the American people. While on the other hand, the Democrats are really bringing their best, because the corrupt people get weeded out really quickly because there's such scrutiny of them. The ones who aren't that strong get weeded out because there's so many really good people. And that is the analogy to soccer, I think, really matters here. But this is why American democracy, including the Republican Party, needs to have a free and fair playing field.
Folks, that's Heather Cox Richardson, professor of history at Boston College, author, 7 books to her name, and author of Letters from an American. You can find that on Substack. We're going to be back in just a moment. I'm going to ask Heather, if she considers herself part of a political party, given our discussion. We're going to dig in more deeply to the history of the Electoral College and what that means to the system and that very level playing field or unlevel playing field as the case may be. After these brief messages, I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network.